This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sevasodhi. It's Live and Learn, and today we're discussing a book, a compilation of findings after consultation with various groups. It's titled Contemporary Malaysian Indians, History, Issues, Challenges and Prospects. It is a new publication focused on major issues facing the Malaysian Indians today, especially those trapped within the bottom 40% of the income ladder. This volume contains 29 chapters written by 34 writers, co-edited by Dato' Dr. Denison Jayasuria and Professor Dr. K.S. Nathan. Both are also Principal Research Fellows at the University Kebangsaan Malaysia, where the book will be launched tomorrow. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. How are you today?
Fine. Thank you, Meera.
It's great. I mean, how did this project come to be, Dr. Denison? I mean, where did the idea come from?
I think this was part of a process in which we wanted to look at all the key issues and concerns of Malaysian Indians. So we had a series of workshops in 2014 where we had identified over 40 different writers, both academics on the one hand, people from government, as well as activists from civil society to look at various themes and issues ranging from history, socioeconomic, contemporary issues, education, a whole ambit of issues. And out of those presentations, papers were selected, they were rewritten, they were then edited. Most of 2015 was rewriting and re-editing. One of the major reasons for this is we have had many smaller writing projects on individual themes and topics, but nothing to the size of over 650 pages worth of material on such cross-cutting subjects. And this is a necessary tool from an academic as well as public policy point of view to review what are the critical. So it's almost like taking stock of what are the issues, what has been done, what are the gaps, where do we go from here? And it fits into the 11th Malaysia Plan on the one hand, as well as the Sustainable Development Goals, which is a longer agenda of the government and the UN.
So bringing it all together has not been done before, Professor Nathan?
Well, I don't think it has been done in the way it has been done this time. Mm-hmm. We address a lot of issues that are really current, although we do sort of contextualize it from history until the present, because it's important to understand how the Indian community in Malaysia evolved and what are their contributions, what are their problems, the issues that they face in the political economy of Malaysia, which is very rapidly changing, mm-hmm. and in what way government might be able to assist them better, and what are the areas or flaws, perhaps even in policy, which need to be sort of focused upon and addressed so that there is no large gap that begins to develop between rich and poor. Mm-hmm. As a whole, we want to make sure that development is balanced and development is inclusive. And that is where we as academics also can play a role in terms of providing the researched material, good studies that are able to be analytical in looking at the problem and suggest also policy recommendations for government to take account.
Do you think that's the reason why we've known, and the reason I ask you this is this, Dr. Denison, we've known the issues that have plagued the Indian community for the longest time. We know roughly in terms of structure, in terms of, you know, in social standing and all of that, we know where we stand. We know what the gaps are. Do you think that because we have not come together and put something in totality or holistically is why we have not been able to address a lot of issues?
No, I think this is an ongoing process. I think where academics previously, right from K.S. Sandhu or Arasaratnam or Tan Sri Marimuthu and many Ambalavanan and others who have researched academic works, largely from University of Malaya background, have documented it from the plantation sector and the much earlier periods. And there are other more contemporary writings related to Hindraft, post-Hindraft, and themes of this sort. I think here we are looking at, in a single volume, cross-sectional themes addressing history, contemporary issues, achievements, gaps. It's an ongoing process. And I think government has attempted in some areas. It has been successful, especially post-2008, through the Prime Minister's initiative and the special institutions. But there are still major gaps. And this is what people are saying. They are recognizing, and I think what Professor Nathan, myself, as we facilitated using through the context of the Institute of Ethnic Studies, was to provide a neutral academic environment to look at the hard facts and then put it down with analysis by each writer who's a subject expert in their particular area, and then take it on from there. We are hoping that government would seriously read this, politicians would read this, future students, socioeconomic research students, will build on this work. But we are also hoping it will inform civil society where they should focus on. I think there are some sections that are completely new, like the one on the demography, where Indians are located, and how the switch from rural to urban, rural plantation to urban, and the pockets of people living in 38 districts. 95% of Indians live in 38 districts of the country. And this has implications not just for where schools are, the housing, it has implications for where the voting blocks are, and things of this sort. And so delivery could be easy if that is targeted. And so government needs to take cognizance of the various input and writing from that end. So I don't think one would say, this is the end all of all of academic. This is a single encyclopedia of Indian issues. There are various topics that have also been left out. But nonetheless, it's an effort that brings people of Indian origin in Malaysia. It's brought academics from overseas. It has brought non-Tamils, Malaysians, who have also written chapters. And it gives that credibility of academic rigor, as well as people directly involved in delivery, like My Skills Foundation, EWRF. They have all written chapters from the service end. And then you have the whole cross-section of academics from economy, sociology, history, international relations, politics, who have also contributed.
Okay. Dr. Dennison, you said when we spoke earlier that you wanted to begin this discussion with reference to the child conversion and custody case of M. Indira Gandhi, as well as the movie Jagat. Why is that?
Now, somebody, when someone who heard about this book then asked me, do the academics have a foothold on a reality check as well? Mm-hmm. So the first question was issues of religious freedom faced by Indians and others. Is it being addressed in the book? And my reply to that individual was yes, because Dato Vaitalingam, in the chapter that he addresses on religious freedom and the Indian community, addresses many of the issues, and he makes specific intervention on Indira Gandhi's case as an example of the struggles vis-a-vis the amendment to the Federal Constitution, Article 121A, of the civil court and the Sharia court, and there are specific recommendations that he raises. So that's being covered. Now, Jagat, because it's a more popularized version of a story, and that story is real, it did take place, similarly of the transition from plantation to urbanized squatters, flats. That's also described in the contemporary challenges. And we had writers from My Skill, both Mr. Pasupati and Selva Mala, who were involved in the movie Jagat, also contributed, because they have, through My Skills, brought out an effective intervention program, and that is presented in the book as a case study. So all we're saying is, a thick academic book, is not just for the bookshelf or something to look nice at, but or at the ivory tower, but it has a reality to the current contemporary struggles of religious freedom or a young person struggling with underachievement, with crime, with violence in a dysfunctional family, or at the bottom 40%. This is at the heart of the book. So I wanted to set it in the context that academicians are not out of touch, or the writers or the editors, but the team of people who came together address from education to economy to politics to religious freedom. All these themes are coming out in that context.
Right. Yeah. Prof. Nathan,
if I might add,
yes, please.
While there are ethnic dimensions to the study, the more important point that we are trying to make is that this problem faced by the Malaysian Indian community is a national problem. So we want the national structures to address what we also consider to be a structural problem. They are caught in this sort of trap of being in the bottom 40%. But it's not only in Malaysian Indians who are in the bottom 40.
Yes.
There are also all other communities, you know, Malays, Chinese, and more specifically the East Malaysians from Sarawak and Sabah. So we have to address it in a national context. And so if we can move policy in the direction of a needs-based approach, rather than just ethnicize the problem, the danger with ethnicizing issues like this is that the other communities can be insensitive to the sensitivities of one community that feels that its problems or its issues and concerns are the most important.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to see it in a Malaysian context. And that's why we suggest that we take the inclusive development approach. And that whatever problems, regardless of ethnicity, must be seen as a national problem. The drug problem, it's a national problem. We can't say it's only belonging to one particular community and therefore the other communities should not worry about it.
Right.
No, it is. It requires this national focus, and the policy mechanisms must all move together and not work in silos. So this is the very important thing, the integration of, you know, policy frameworks and tools so that these issues are seen in a more nationalized context.
How do we break down those walls? Because policies have always been very race-based. You are almost fighting against the tide. How will you do that?
In the current context, we are looking at the 11th Malaysia Plan. The public policy of the 11th Plan, and including the sustainable development goals that Malaysia has endorsed with the United Nations as the agenda for the next 15 years, brings the theme of inclusive development, no one left behind. I think the challenge for us is to ensure that the civil service in its delivery responds to all human need, as what Prof. Nathan is saying. So when we look at urban poor or we look at underachievers, they should look at all communities that are affected, because every Malaysian is a resource for the country. And so in that sense, public policy is there. It's now the monitoring, the delivery, the disaggregated data that need to be collected over time to then show that. So people who are in crime, young people or families that are dysfunctional or the poor, irrespective of ethnicity, need to be addressed. But where issues might be particularly impacting a particular community, say, for example, indigenous people in the forest or something, then specific interventions are needed. And this book brings that theme out, that while we are saying inclusive development for all, we need to also specifically target if there were displaced plantation people who are living in a housing that is not really sorted out, or in flats, or there are specific religious freedom issues. You need to find a solution that is practical, that will address the issues. I think our problem is sometimes institutions or people ignore it. And I think Prof. Nathan is right, that all these concerns should not be relegated as a sub-ethnic community concern. It's the national concern. And the very fact, since 2008, that the Prime Minister's office has set up so many different units to address this concern, then it's a national concern of the federal government and likewise other state governments that need to organize intervention. Now we need to see whether it's reaching this bottom target or not.
And obviously it's not. So that's what we're discussing today, the compilation of articles or findings from a series of consultations which happened over a year, and then putting the book together another year. It's taken them 2 years to actually put this book together. It's titled Contemporary Malaysian Indians, History, Issues, Challenges and Prospects. Will be launched tomorrow, Friday, at UKM. We have Dr. Denison Jayasuriya and Professor Dr. K.S. Nathan, both co-editors of this book. When we come back, we'll find out more about government intervention. Dr. Denison, you spoke about efforts by the Prime Minister's office in 2008. Obviously, in my opinion, that money has not reached the people. What's going on? How will your findings help towards a proper solution? Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Live and Learn. I'm Meera Sivisodhi. That's Dr. Denison Jayasuriya, co-editor and principal research fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies, UKM, together with his colleague, Professor Dr. K.S. Nathan, also co-editor and principal research fellow at UKM. Both very played an instrumental role in bringing together this book titled Contemporary Malaysian Indians, History, Issues, Challenges and Prospects. A two-year effort bringing in different writers, 34 writers altogether, to look at various issues that plague the Indian community, the contemporary Indian community. What do you mean by that, Professor Nathan?
Well, contemporary Malaysian Indians, well, they make up about 8% of the population of Malaysia, which is around 30 million. So the Indians make up about 2.4 million.
Mm-hmm. That's a large
number. And yeah.
That's a large number.
That's a large number, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And quite a number of the bottom 40% tend to
be. How much would you say of the 2.4%? 2.4 million.
Maybe 30%. It's quite large.
It is large.
30 to 40%.
Yes, quite large.
Because of income levels that we are looking at.
Right. Okay. And largely due to the fragmentation of estates, they were driven out and they came with very little or no skills to the urban areas to eke out a living. Very poor preparation. And this is where we feel the government policy should have kicked in to ensure a smoother transition from the rural area to the urban area.
Where did the Indian fall by the wayside along the way? After coming to Malaya and, you know, progressing, I mean, a lot of people have done well, but 30 to 40% is a huge number. At what stage did they fall by the wayside?
Well, it's a combination of, you know, policies, colonial policies, as well as, you know, the post-independence government. They also had priorities. You know, there was the pro-Malay policies, you know, which were given more focus. And as a result of that, of course, the Indians, you know, were not sufficiently sort of looked into their kinds of needs and so on. So I think there was also political failure in that sense, not only by the government, but also parties representing the Indian community as well. So it's a collective problem that we are facing, and that's why we need to now address this problem also collectively and move forward. The government working with civil society, working with political parties that represent the Indian community, all have to work together. And we take the positive approach that a book like this can highlight the concerns and create greater sensitivity among the Indian community itself. Those who are well off, you know, can help those who are not so well off, which I think is a very important principle.
It is a very important principle.
That the more fortunate Indians help the less fortunate Indians.
But there is a gap there.
There is a gap there.
Because the intermediaries are not people we trust. And that's where the failure of this well-off Indians helping the less well-off Indians. There is the people in between have affected that trust in, you know, the well-off having that trust that you will indeed go ahead and help the bottom 40%.
I think the change since 2008 has been that the federal government set up a cabinet committee and subsequently it was pointed out in the planning of the 10th Malaysia Plan that delivery didn't have dedicated institutions. And as a result, four special units were set up. They're all in either the Prime Minister's office or the department addressing. And in this book, there are three chapters highlighting what they have done, like seed in the context of microeconomic development and working through Tekun and other financial institutions for training. They have given their data. There are still weaknesses, there are gaps, there are still numerous other needs for economic development, but that's one step. The Professor N.S. Rajendran writes about Tamil school development and the enormous funding to improve the infrastructure of Tamil schools, one, and two, the quality of Tamil school education likewise has gone up. And there is a unit looking into those things. And thirdly, another unit that Dato Sivasubramaniam has been working on is on citizenship issues. So there have been specific mechanisms that were not there before, because earlier it was either political party or individual organizations that did it. But now there are these in place. And hopefully in the 11th plan with inclusive development and various other issues, all agencies of government, irrespective of what they are, would start addressing critical issues and concerns like education, skills training, these sort of things. And so while the issues continue, because as Prof. Nathan earlier said, there are also similar issues, because the 40% yes. also includes other communities. So you've got Sabahan, Sarawakian, sizable sections of the Malay community, urban poor, they fall into it. So likewise, there are many displaced communities because the bottom 40% in the 11th plan is 2.7 million people, you know, or households. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge sum, and Indians also are part of that process. And that's being documented. So some of these efforts have been highlighted on the government side. And likewise, the other chapters that look at Millennium Development Goals or the development model or Muhammad's issue on inequality, the chapter on urban poverty begins to flesh out unresolved and ongoing work that needs to take place.
How do we address this issue of funds not reaching the people it should?
Well,
leakages
is,
along the way. Because you said efforts have been made by the Prime Minister's office in 2008.
Since 2008.
Yes, and large sums of money have been allocated. You said a lot has been allocated for Tamil schools, for infrastructure. We still see a ton of Tamil schools, which infrastructure is really dilapidated. I mean, are there leakages along the way? What's going on?
Well, I would think the civil service has a very important role to play in this, because they are the ones who implement the policies made at higher levels. So we need to sensitize the civil service. This also means actually we need to actually multi-racialize the civil service. Not exactly in terms of the percentages of the population we have, but certainly there has to be a more representative Malaysian civil service, not made up completely of only one ethnic group, but of all ethnic groups. Then you'll find that there are also checks and balances that will arise in that process, and that policies made above will be translated into practice, and then the enforcement mechanisms are honored. What is happening is that there is no enforcement. You know, the gods consent, but the priests are dissenting. Mm-hmm. So this is where, as you say, that the failure is arising, the lack of sensitivity to issues that are seen purely from an ethnic perspective rather than a national perspective.
Okay, so the book also addresses, I think, that Tayani Kananatu in Chapter 9 wrote about the policies that target the social, economic and political grievances of the Indians, and there were errors in the past, in past policies, and there are reparative measures in nature. I mean, did you agree with everything that Tayani wrote about?
I think one, if one addressed the issues from human rights perspective, and I think Prof. Nathan earlier made reference to the plantation economy and the struggles of the end, the transition from the plantation economy into the urban areas, I think people were left to find their own housing and the transition. And I think public intervention did not address the concerns adequately. And likewise now, if we take urban poverty issues or underachievement in the schools and problem high-risk youth, there isn't sufficient organized efforts to address the structural issues, family-based issues, and things of that sort. So I think in what is being highlighted in the chapters, if one took on the citizen and the rights-based approach, which is linked to needs-based as well, looking at every individual and their access to the resources, whether people look at people in a colorblind way and see them as persons in need and addressing their concerns, then I think we will move further on. So I think as we are discussing, disaggregated data is necessary. A far greater mix of the civil service is also necessary. A greater accountability process of where money was given to whom, how was it spent, even in the past and even now. I think it's critical because when people don't know or whether it has reached and things, adequate dissemination of information and access. And I think the Prime Minister's office has altered this for all new grants coming out from last year, that one has to fill a form, there was a selection process, and then there is a website that highlights the criteria, and then it's given. So it's no more on the basis of political patronage, at least the sums given through the budgetary consideration. And I think you need impact assessment and evaluation that is independent. So I think as the book took that effort, likewise, if this is encouraged, then more qualitative, quantitative studies to show what is the net impact and effect would also be necessary. Most often, reports are written by government agencies, not by independent assessors. Yes. And likewise, the academic institutions could play that role. And this is one effort that we have taken. And hopefully, it will lead on to preventing these leakages that people have accused of. I have also have been accused of these things before. But I think an accountable social dialogue process, people's opportunity to question, greater scrutiny from media is, I think, necessary. A social audit, financial audit, and more transparency is needed, especially in the use of public funds.
Let's look inward now. The Malaysian Indians have a rich sub-ethnic diversity, and that in itself divides us to a very large extent. What were your findings? Did you look at that, and you know, is there a way around this problem? It is a problem in my
opinion. It is a challenge, and this is where I think self-empowerment is very, very important. And there must be the sensitivity to the fact that we are all Malaysians, and if we are of Indian ethnic origin, regardless of our sub-ethnic dimensions, we are able to see that empowering the entire community is in our own interest, and it's also in the national interest. So the empowerment is actually a two-way process. One is the Indian community, the civil society, the business groups show greater sensitivity and a sense of concern for those others whom they can help. There must be that feeling as well. Because government, to put all the responsibility of government is also not fair. We must show that we can empower ourselves. And then you find that the government can chip in and empower us even further. That's how empowerment works. Mm-hmm. It's a two-way process. So once they see that the Indians can unite and can work together, and then the richer Indians, you know, show concern for the poorer Indians, surely any government will see that, yeah, these are people who do care, and let's see what we can do using our resources to sort of establish a policy framework by which we can empower not only the Indian community, but all communities in the bottom 40%. That will mean a national empowerment that will make Malaysia great and enable us achieve the Vision 2020 that we are headed towards.
Actually, if I may just add on, there are two chapters address this quite seriously. One is the chapter by Professor Dr. Terence Gomez on alternative models and inequality. And the other is by Dr. Muhammad Abdul Khalid on inclusive development. And they are taking of rising inequalities on a class basis, intra-ethnic basis. I think we have to recognize within the Indian community, there is a historically advantaged section of the Indian community that is much more English-speaking, or they came in the professional context. And there were those who were in the plantation sector. While we use an inclusive term, we are now specifically looking at families at the bottom, and they really need our assistance through public sector intervention. And I think the Indians on the higher income and professional bracket, if we look at the organizations that are really organizing things, like the Sri Murugan Center by Tansri Tambiraja, or the EWRF, or My Skills Foundation, are all led by middle-class Indians who have contributed their funds and resources. It's only in recent times public funds are being allocated to these organizations as well, especially since 2015 and 2016 through the 100 million grant that's being done. So there is that challenge. Lots need to be done. And there is a saying, the poor will be among us. But definitely looking at the deprivation and the holistic need to address these concerns would require, as Prof. Nathan also mentioned, a total national policy and agenda. I think government is saying it, but I think on the ground, let's say we take the 38 districts where we have 95% Indian, and that 38 districts would also have the largest number of poorer Indians, then what are the mechanisms at the ground level? Those are some questions being asked in this book.
Do you think that geographical spread makes it more difficult to address issues?
I think the locations are not very far apart. Okay. 38 districts in 9 states. We seem to be where the plantations were on the west coast of the peninsula. And people then moving from the plantation moved on to closer towns. Klang, Seremban, Port Dickson, then you got Pry, where the factories are, or Ipoh. So these, or Johor Bahru. So these locations, or Kedah, Sungai Petani area. So the heavy concentration of Indians, like while we might be only 8% at the national figure, at the district level, we might be as high as 20%, 30%, like Klang, is 20% of the district population is actually the Indian community.
Mm-hmm. Which ideally is, should make it easier for,
yes, you know,
for us to mobilize and do whatever that needs to be done.
But whether the agencies are now allocating 20% of resources in,
right,
Klang, in terms of personnel, budget, dialogues, discussion, to the community. Likewise, Port Dickson, Seremban, Pry, I think, could even go up as high as 40%. Bentong and Ipoh is something like 50% Indians living in that part of that, city.
District.
So there's an area which is high concentration of Indians in certain, like Kajang, Simini area. It's a very high proportion of Indians due to this displacement and shift, and where factories are, where the flats are. And some flats areas like Desa Mentari, the Prof and I visited as well, I think some blocks will be 70, almost 60% would be Indians. And then you're talking of 300, 400 families living in walking distance to each other in high-rise 21 stories. You know, and that has certain demands from local authority, and these are questions being raised in public sector, and civil society intervention has to be far more directed to addressing these concerns.
A reviewer...
I would add on that score that, you see, where there are problems, we must also see opportunities.
Yeah.
And this is our approach, that we you know, sort of flip the coin and see, okay, behind adversity also lies the opportunity. Why don't we focus our talents, energies and resources on seeing how we can now work together and move the community forward? And then when we collectively empower our community, the government will join in. I always believe that the government will chip in the moment they see that this community is trying its best to upgrade itself. So I think that is where the secret is, civil society and government working together.
Right. So what's the way forward in terms of advocacy? I mean, you're done with the book. It's the beginning of a long journey, actually, launching tomorrow.
Yes,
what happens after that?
The launch is tomorrow, and at the launch, it's more a formal event. We have invited outstanding academic Professor A. Money to review the book. But we went on beyond the launch to also organize a seminar on Saturday on the topic with Professor R.K. Jain, His Excellency Kesavapani, and Professor A. Money, and moderated by Professor K.S. Nathan, a discussion on the book, which could be interactive and so forth. But we are hoping that this book will become a resource material for students, government agencies. We plan to try and get an appointment with the Prime Minister, Economic Planning Unit, to present it to them, to study the findings and see how best they can draw on these for the 11th plan as well as the sustainable development goals.
Yes, I would like to really give credit to all the writers, chapter writers. Dr. Dennison has pointed out, 25 of them are having PhDs. So these are serious people who have researched the community. They have done a lot of field work. And the data in the book is really very rich and can serve as a policy framework for government to perhaps shift or rearrange its policies so that the delivery systems are far more effective.
Right. And for the ordinary person like you and I, as to how we can use it as a resource. I mean, when I watched Jagat, I'll be honest, gentlemen, I felt this sense of hopelessness, of not being able, you know, the problem seemed huge. And I thought to myself, even if I want to make a difference, where do I even start, you know?
Right. I would say change always starts with the individual. It is our mindset. If we say that it is hopeless, then we don't have to do anything. But if we say there is hope, then immediately we will see that within us, the resources begin to develop, the vision begins to develop, the commitment begins to develop, and our hands and legs and mind begin to move in the direction of solving the problem.
Okay.
So it's for the Indian community, this is the best approach.
Thank you very much. I will let go of that whole sense of hopelessness. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining
us
today. Where do we get a copy of the book? Will it be available?
At this point, from the
evening, the copies.
Okay.
The
university?
Yes.
At the university, yes.
Okay,
yes,
no
yes.
Leading public...
At this point, we haven't discussed with MPH or...
Bookstores.
Yes, Budaya, we will do it soon.
Okay, thank you both very much for joining me today. Dr. Dennison Jayasuriya and Professor K.S. Nathan, both co-editors of a book titled Contemporary Malaysian Indians, History, Issues, Challenges and Prospects, Principal Research Fellows at the University Kebangsaan Malaysia on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.